Hello.
Hello.
Hola.
Hola.
Bonjour.
Здравствуйте.
Bienvenidos and welcome
to Radio Natura.
Radio Natura.
To Radio Natura.
Voices from around the world,
bringing you all things related to nature and sustainability.
Rethinking what it means to live in peace with nature.
And imagining a brighter future.
Brought to you by the Pax Natura Foundation.
Welcome to a new episode of Radio Natura. My name is Vincent Latjes. Today's episode centers on Sustainable Development Goal number 13, Target 1, being climate action, strengthen resilience and adaptive capacity to climate-related hazards and natural disasters in all countries. I would like to express my gratitude to the Nature Museum and Seal Rescue of Texel, the Netherlands, Ecomare, which has opened its doors to let this interview take place at. For this, I would like to start by saying thank you to Anneke Schrama, manager of Ecomare, on behalf of Radio Natura. Climate change causes an increased erosion of coasts, leading to rapid decrease of coastal ecosystems. This effect is being amplified by a decrease in coastal vegetation such as mangroves, coral reefs, and sea grasses. Restoration of these flora can also help mitigate strong wave action causing coastal erosion. This works on one hand by the plant stems to form a degrading resistance underwater to waves and on the other hand by keeping the sediment in place with their roots, preventing erosion. This can mitigate the devastating effects hurricanes or even tsunamis have on coasts. Moreover, coastal vegetation is highly capable of storing carbon, ultimately leading to a decrease in atmospheric carbon dioxide. A team of Dutch researchers have successfully managed to realize restoration of areas of subtropical and temperate seagrass and salt marsh systems through their research in 2019, which got published in 2020. Subtropical and temperate seagrass and salt marsh systems are types of coastal vegetations naturally occurring in coastal areas that have been rapidly decreasing due to pressure on their habitat, both by humans and nature. The restoration was realized by deploying biodegradable structures derived from potato waste. These structures support coastal flora to be resistant to strong wave action so they can safely root when planted. At today's show, I would like to welcome Chisse van der Heijden, co-author of the publication and part of the team responsible for this exciting research. Chisse, what I would like to start with is, I would like to hear from you, what was your last experience with nature?
Yeah, well, I also don't get out that much as I used to due to the COVID restrictions, of course, but actually I've been to the sand engine not that long ago. So that's the big sandbar that is near Scheveningen, and which is used basically as a sand conveyor belt to add sand to the Dutch shore as a solution to prevent erosion at these sites.
So I assume you were there on a professional...
I was there on a professional basis, yes. Yeah. Yeah, with a limited group of people, but at that time that was still, that could still just happen, yeah.
And in regards to the project, what has been your contribution and your personal connection to it?
Actually, this whole thing already started 10 years ago, I have to say. So I'm one of the conceivers of the whole idea, you could say. And in 2010, I was working as a researcher on mussel bed restoration in the Warren Sea. And what we tried was basically what happened in the Warren Sea is that intertidal mussel beds weren't doing that well at the time. It's improving now, but at the time it was really poor. And we were investigating on how we could restore them. And one of the ideas was to simply get mussels from the channels, from the gullies in the Warren Sea, where they are more abundant still, and then just put them onto the intertidal flats and basically let them form their own mussel bed again. So we did that, and we put these adult mussels from the channels on the intertidal, and we found that they flush straight back into the channels within a matter of months. And what we found was that basically these mussels are not adapted to life in the intertidal. So they grew up, it's the same species, but they grew up in the channels, and hence they are used to growing in conditions without many waves, because it's very deep, so the waves don't reach the bottom, but high flow velocity, so lots of food. So they're basically rather thick fat mussels, but they don't invest a lot of energy in attaching to each other, so they flush out quite easily. And at the same time, we found also that if you place a little bit of hard substrate or stable substrate on the seafloor, and in that case we used a coconut mat, and at the same time you keep out predators like shrimp and crab, that mussels just settle straight from the water column. So the small mussel larvae, they normally grow up in the water column for a number of weeks, and then they typically prefer to settle on their parents, so the adult mussel beds, but those were gone, of course, so we can't get them back that way, so they try to settle on the sand instead. But there are typically lots of shrimp and crab are waiting for them to eat them, and the sand is also very unstable. And we found that if we keep the crabs and the shrimp out, and at the same time stabilize the sediment with the coconut mat, then you just get a mini mussel bed within no time. And basically we simulate the conditions that are naturally present at an adult mussel bed. So that's how we got to the idea, well, if we can have a biodegradable structure that temporarily just simulates being a mussel bed to just trick the small mussels into settling on this structure, then the structure can fall apart afterwards and you're left with a natural mussel bed again. So that's the principle of the idea. And then we realized, yeah, well, if you think about coastal systems, well, these mussels kind of have a chicken and egg problem, you could say. If there's no mussel bed, it's very difficult to get this mussel bed back. But the same holds for seagrasses, that if you have a very big seagrass bed, a large seagrass bed that holds on to sediment very firmly and takes out a lot of the energy from the waves, then you have very clear waters, very stable sediments, and the plants, they grow very nicely, they do very well, because the meadow itself stabilizes the environment. So it basically creates its own favorable growing conditions. And the same holds for salt marshes. Also, these plants stabilize the sediment, take out the energy from the water, trap a lot of sediment even from the water column, on which they grow better. But if they're gone, and you just plant a single seagrass plant back, or a single salt marsh plant, then waves will just come in and sweep the plants away, and you can't restore them that way. So what if you just could temporarily simulate the critical traits that these plants have, so holding on to sediment, taking out energy from the waves, and just temporarily simulate that in order to get the actual plant established. And that's how the idea got born. So we basically, in this project, we not only tested on seagrasses and salt marsh, but also tested on mussel reefs and even in peatlands. And this particular publication is then on the salt marshes and the seagrasses. Yeah. Yeah.
It's very interesting. So that was, well, more or less a breakdown on how it actually functions. And can you explain to us to what extent is this invention, this innovation, as I would say, capable of influencing coastal ecosystems?
Well, so what we show in the publication, of course, is that if you add this structure, so I brought it here as well, not for the listeners to see, but it's yeah. easier to talk about it as well if you just have it in your hands, I guess. But if you put
we'll post a picture on the website for our listeners to look it back afterwards.
So if you add it into the sediment, of course, it stabilizes the sediment, and then you can just plant the plant in the middle of the structure, and it will just go through it. And the idea is then that basically that way we can restore seagrass beds if you use it on top of the sediment. We found that for salt marsh plants it actually works much better. So for seagrass, it appears that stabilization of the sediment is most important, but for salt marsh plants, it's actually taking out the energy from the currents and stabilizing the above ground stems of the plant, so the stalks. And in both cases, basically, the structure helps out the plant temporarily and then lets it grow, and then should fall apart again, same with the mussels. Yeah. And of course, if we can do that successfully at a sufficient scale, then we have the potential to rebuild mussel beds, to rebuild salt marshes, or to rebuild seagrass beds, or other types of ecosystems that function in a similar manner.
Yeah. So so you say we're talking about seagrasses and mussels here, and if we're talking about other aquatic flora, such as coral reefs or say mangroves, is this project also feasible for application for these other aquatic flora?
It's a very good question. Of course, when you think about this and when we realize that it doesn't only work for mussels but also for seagrasses and for salt marsh, then you start thinking about, well, what other types of systems function in a similar manner? And oyster reefs, it's the same story. Also, these oyster larvae need to create a reef out of nothing on bare sediment. Same goes for corals, like you mentioned. And also mangroves, they also maintain their environment in a similar way, or even dune plants. they need to build a dune. Maybe we can help these plants build a dune more rapidly and actually get established.
So in a non-aquatic environment?
Yeah. Even so, basically the principle of temporarily helping these habitat-forming organisms, so basically these are all, these plants and these mussels, they're all species or organisms that build their own environment to their own benefit. This principle is basically applicable to each of these systems where this principle holds. So if these organisms are important to create their own conditions for sustaining themselves, then you could in principle think of a way to temporarily simulate these traits and help the organism out and get established. Not necessarily with this particular structure, of course, but the principle holds for all these habitat forming organisms, you could argue.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, and if we're talking about a long-term solution, as this project might be, how feasible is this? How sustainable would this innovation be on the long term?
At the moment, it's still at an experimental stage, you could say. So we are scaling up. We're running tests with salt marshes at a scale of hundreds of squares of meters now. So it's already we started with 1 square meter. Keep that in mind. And now we're at maybe 100 or 200 square meters in size with the experiments. Yeah. Of course, we want to scale up at a landscape scale. So we need to go to hectares.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that you have to basically put out hectares and hectares of this stuff, but you need to create patches of this material with the plants in it, so that these plants form patches all over the landscape that then eventually connect again. And if you do it that way, it's very much feasible in the long run to do it that way. Of course, so the idea is not to have hectares and hectares of this stuff, because it would make it very expensive and it would make it not so very environmentally friendly, because this stuff also has to be produced, of course. But if you can come up with a way of creating the ideally sized patches, or maybe a range of patches, some small, some large, and you put them at distances that eventually they can connect to each other again, so that you allow them to cross that establishment threshold, then this is very much feasible to upscale.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the external influences that have previously made these seagrasses, for example, flush away.
Yeah.
On the long term, aren't these influences posing a threat anymore? Once this,
of course, it's very important that so this stuff is now we've mainly tested it for taking out energy from currents and waves and stabilizing the sediment. In many cases, these seagrass beds have not disappeared due to the currents and the waves, but they've disappeared, for instance, due to excessive nutrient input from agriculture, or just the straightforward removal of salt marshes or seagrass beds because we wanted to have infrastructure there, or we built dikes over there, and that is typically what has removed them. Other types of stresses, and when these are taken away, then it's still very difficult to get them back in conditions where the hydrodynamics are very strong, because these plants cannot get established there. In theory, if you wait long enough, you can get them back without this, but then you need a very calm period that will just happen by accident every once in a while.
Yeah.
But then it may take 50 years or 100 years for the plant to get back. And with this, you basically create these conditions and you don't need that calm period, and you can basically recreate it almost instantaneously, you could argue. So that's the idea. But of course, it's very important that all these other conditions are already suitable for the growth of the plant. And that's the very first step.
And so you've talked about upscaling the project.
Yeah.
And aside, well, next to this, what would be the next step in fully deploying this technology?
It depends per ecosystem, I'd say. So we've tested it for a number of systems. And for the salt marshes, this seems to work already really well. So we're already in the process of scaling that up at an intermediate scale right now. And for seagrasses, we could also do the same, basically. But for mussels, for instance, it's still not there. The structure itself for mussel bed restoration degrades basically still somewhat too slowly. And because the structure is made up of separate sheets that are 2 centimeters high, 1 meter wide, and half a meter long. And you basically click them together like Legos, and this connection system is basically, if you try to apply for mussel beds, is also kind of its weakness, because when the structure starts to degrade, this clicking system, this system that holds the different components, these different layers together, is the first to give away. And then what you can get is that these layers start to fall apart, and if they start to do so before the mussel bed has established sufficiently, then you basically get this lost into the environment. Yeah. And eventually it degrades, but of course you you want it to stay in place until it starts to degrade. And so for mussel beds, that we're not there yet, but for plant growth, because the plants basically anchor this down immediately in between their root mats, it works really well. But also there, we would like to have it degrade somewhat quicker than that is currently the case. Okay. So I think that for the biodegradability, so the speed of degradation is definitely still an issue in all these systems, and we're working on that. Actually pretty close to a solution for that as we speak. But for reefs, for instance, I think we need a design change. So we've shown proof of principle, but now the next step is to actually come up with the design that's more tailor-made per ecosystem, you could say. And mm-hmm. for that, we're actually now looking into 3D printing these structures rather than making them, this is made with injection molding. So it's a fixed structure, you could say, a mold, and the biopolymers are injected in there in a fluid form, so they're heated, they're injected in there, and then it's cooled down, and you have the sheet as a result. And of course, that's a fixed shape, it's a mold. But when you print it, you can basically make any form you like. And then it makes it also much more easy, of course, to tailor make it depending on whether you want to have mussels there or oysters, or whether you want to have a different species of seagrass to facilitate. And for that, you need industrial-sized 3D printers, but that's nowadays, that's increasingly starting to become a reality. So we're actually experimenting with that at the moment. Yeah.
And does the use of 3D printers also enable the option to use different types of material?
Yeah. So with these injection molds, I was talking about this system that connects these different sheets to each other. Mm-hmm. This is a clicking system, and of course, if you want to click something together, you need a rather hard type of bioplastic because it needs to click. But with 3D printing, you could print much more flexible types of bioplastics, and then you basically glue them together when they're still hot, yeah. And coming from the printer. So I've also here a small piece as an example, and it's much more elastic-like, compared to the material that we've been experimenting with so far. And that's just because we use different biopolymers for this, a different mix. And with these printers, we can play around with the different biopolymers. We can even mix the different biopolymers to different degrees and tune the biodegradability that way, and also tune the material properties so we can make it stiffer or even more flexible than this, make it degrade in a year or in 5 years or 10 years. And this is a work in progress, I'd say.
Yeah, of course. And you've told that at the first test round, the structures take too long to break down. And how will this improve? What is the outlook at this moment?
So the structures we've been testing with break down rather slowly. And this was also, because it's a prototype, this was also done on purpose. You can imagine that if we would design a structure that would break down in 3 months, we don't even have the time to test the principle, so we purposely chose a material that degrades, but degrades slowly. So this takes longer than 10 years. And of course, so if you're in a salt marsh and the structures would sand in immediately and the plants overgrow it, you never see it again. Maybe in 100 years it's gone anyway. So it's not a huge problem, but you don't need it to be around that long. Yeah. So we want to have more rapidly degrading biopolymers, and it can be anything basically from half a year to 10 or 15 years, or even longer, depending on the polymers that you choose. Mm-hmm. So, and you can imagine that for a salt marsh, these plants, they to get them established, it takes approximately 2 years on average, the species that we're working with now. So you want this material to fall apart maybe in 3 years, right? And for mussel beds, it's kind of the same time scale. But for if you want to really also, for instance, test on coral reefs, well, you can imagine corals grow a lot slower, and you want also the material to degrade a lot slower. So it really depends on the application, and this is also part of the, so these 3D printers, they allow us to make any shape possible, which allows us to make tailor-made shapes depending on the species, but also the degradability of the material should also be tailor-made. So depending on the species in the system, we should be able to choose different degradation rates.
Yeah. Okay. And as I've just told in the intro, the first structures were made from biopolymers derived from potato waste.
Yeah, in part.
Well, to explain a little bit more to our listeners who are not familiar with terms like biopolymers?
So basically there's a whole range of biopolymers that you can use, and the biopolymers that you get from potatoes is simply starch. And the starch can be modified in different ways to also slow down the biodegradability and make it behave more like a plastic, because that's what you want. But it simply just starts with a limited number of additives, and that degrades relatively quickly. You can imagine you eat starch if you eat a potato. So yeah. That degrades relatively quickly also in a marine environment. And if you want to have it degrade more slowly, you add other types of biopolymers. A new class of biopolymers, for instance. So it's a little bit technical, so I'm not sure how deep I should go into the matter, but a different, rather new class is the PHAs, polyhydroxyalkanoaten, and they're made by bacteria, so they're also produced by organisms, and they are extracted from these bacteria, and those you can use, and then that's also still a rather rapidly degrading biopolymer. And on the other far end of the spectrum, we have the PLA, the polylactic acid. And that is a very often used material right now, and there's also a lot of debate around it. Maybe some of you have heard it, the PLA on its own, so the polylactic acids, they degrade, and they degrade rather quickly in an industrial compost facility where the temperature of the compost is 60 degrees. But if you put that out in a marine environment, just PLA as such,
that's gonna take
you will find it back in 50 years.
So
is that then still biodegradable? And then there's anything in between. And basically by playing around with these different compounds and by mixing them in different fractions, you can tune this biodegradability. So we can play around with that.
Okay.
That's the principle.
And when taking in consideration upscaling the project, using these different kinds of polymers, how feasible is this actually?
Well, to some degree, of course, it could be limited by production. And of course, you also don't want to use it in massive amounts if it can be used in better ways in other. So there's going to be for the PHAs, for instance, so the bacterial produced biopolymer. There's simply right now there's competition, you could argue, for the for their use. So you can use it in all sorts of applications, but there's just a shortage of it right now because the we're not very efficient yet in producing it. So if you would to just go out and try to buy any kind of PHA, you're gonna have a hard time. Some of them are easily, you can still get quite easily, but others are almost impossible to get. So those are perhaps not the types of polymers we'll be looking at to upscale. And we'll be rather looking at biopolymers that can be more rapidly produced. There's a number of them available. Some of them are completely biological. So completely also renewable, I should say. So they're from waste. Others are still partly renewable and partly from oil still. So that's it's a combination. And then there are even those that are completely from oil yet, but that you can in principle also produce from renewables. And those are the ones we're interested in, all of them, because we're working at an experimental stage. So if the outlook is that they can in the future become renewable, they're interesting for us, especially if they can be produced easily at an industrial scale, because then the potential for competition with other applications is much smaller.
And when we're talking about the use of oil, are we talking about mineral oils, or are we talking about vegetable oils, or?
No, really oil. And of course that is something we're not using in this current product right now, but some of the biopolymers that are degrading more rapidly than this one are actually still partly based on just oil. So they're 50% oil, you could say oil derived, and 50% renewables derived. And then that final step to make it completely renewable derived still has to be made. We're not there yet. So it's basically one big mix of experiments. The suppliers are still experimenting and trying to optimize their raw material that we have to then use in order to produce our end product.
It's basically just mapping the options at this, this stage. And but I'm wondering, when we're using mineral oil or biodegradable structures, that seems to be contradicting in a way.
In essence, it's the same as you could argue with the transition towards sustainable energy. You want to definitely get rid of it. It is something that you definitely also shouldn't want to apply all over the world before it is actually completely renewable based. But of course, before you reach that stage, you can learn everything there is to learn about these products. We know it's possible to produce it that way, to produce completely renewable, but it has to be done still. And the same with the PHAs. Before you can actually produce it at a relevant scale, we also can't apply it, even though it's completely bacterial derived. So yeah, it's important to understand the possibilities, and then of course we have to make smart decisions for upscaling and exclude the oil in the whole equation. Yeah. And that's the end goal.
Okay. And you've also mentioned the use of waste as an application for biopolymers.
Yeah.
What kind of waste are we talking about in this case?
So if you go to a potato factory,
yeah,
and they make fries and they cut the fries every time, and every time you cut them you get a little bit of waste.
Yeah.
But if you cut many fries you get a whole lot of waste, big bags full of it.
Yeah.
That's the waste that has been incorporated as starch in this material. So that will always also remain to be a component in here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very interesting because it's basically, well, the perfect idea of how a circular economy works.
Yes. Yeah.
We partly eat potatoes and partly we implicate it to retrieve nature that has been lost before.
Exactly.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So, as a final question to you, Chissa, I would like to end with a small call for action for our listeners. And the question is as following: what can our listeners do to get involved to help maintain or restore our coastal ecosystems?
It's a very difficult, much encompassing question, you could say. Of course, at a smaller scale, you could say you could be involved in small-scale restoration experiments. So, already now, when we run these experiments, I don't put them out there myself on my own.
Yeah.
We always have help, and for instance, volunteers from nature organizations like Natuurmonumenten often help out, for which we're very grateful. So people can be involved in that way.
Yeah.
Another example in protecting our coasts was perhaps the Zoe disaster, where lots of people, of course, helped cleaning up the beach. And after that, some of my research focused on what happened to these small plastic pellets that ended up all over the beach, and we called people to help us basically count these pellets on the beach to just get an idea of where they ended up. So those kinds of citizen science initiatives, of course, are always very nice, also for us as scientists, to see that people are involved in that. So, but yeah, of course, on the overall level of basically the threat of seeing the sea come up on the one side and basically the our infrastructure closing into these ecosystems on the other side, as an individual it's very difficult to do anything about that. But as society, of course, we have to stop and think about it and value the services that are being provided by these ecosystems, because like you also already explained in your introduction, we depend on them. They are very important for our coastal protection. If you have a large salt marsh in front of a dike, the dike can actually simply be lower. And if you have an oyster reef in front of it, then maybe it can be lower still. And of course, the dunes are extremely important for our coastal protection and for our drinkwater facility. So yeah, it's very important to protect these systems as a society, but that, as an individual is very hard. But of course, you can keep that in mind and try to not litter the beach and so on. So yeah,
perfect.
There's all these different levels.
Yeah, that's a very, very beautiful call for action. Chissa, I want to thank you very much for this interview.
Thank you.
And thank you to everybody at home who has been listening and enjoying our podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We hope you all enjoyed this episode. We'd like to thank Chissa van der Heijden, Anneke Schrama and the Nature Museum and Seal Rescue Ecomare Texel. This podcast is sponsored by the Pax Natura Foundation, www.paxnatura.org. Get in touch with us at podcast@paxnatura.org.